Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 254, and we're going to talk about some road myths. Not myths about, like, roads, but driving myths. Things that you believe that may not be true. We're also going to talk about cigarette lighter outlets and why you still want one in your van, a product review of a rather ambitious multi-tool, and a place to visit that has pirates and a submarine and a nice snack. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you for joining me today. A couple of notes here. First off, if you have not received an email from me concerning your imminent sticker delivery, that means something went wrong. And please write me again, because so far as I know, right now I'm caught up completely on stickers. And I have some good news. I have learned that the U.S. Postal Service has changed the way they handle international mail. I can now just buy these stickers, stamps. The stamps are stickers. See, I'm so old. I remember I used to lick the stamps. Yeah, well, anyway. You can now buy pre-made stamps that are good for mail to just about everywhere. So I'm going to remove the restrictions on stickers for countries that I can use these stickers for, basically. So here's the deal. It costs me personally about $3 to send an envelope with a sticker in it to somebody outside the U.S. Let's see, it cost me about $2 to do it in the U.S. So there is some cost here. But you folks have been so generous with the Buy Me a Coffee thing that it's fine. It's fine. So if anybody would like a sticker, you can let me know. It's a Hook Walk a Bang sticker, !! It is a Euro decal sticker. The symbol resonates with people. It's the official symbol of the College of Curiosity, which is the overarching brand that I have that produces things like this podcast. Okay, enough about that. Let's get into driving myths. Kind of drive me crazy because driving is such an important thing. We take it for granted. We think of it just like walking. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to drive to the store, without taking into account that you're putting other people's lives in danger and yours. It's a massive responsibility. Every time I go around one of those long curves at speed, I am keenly aware that if either one of us temporarily lost our grip of the steering wheel, we could very likely crash into each other and die. You have maybe your finger and your thumb holding onto the steering wheel, and one slip, and you're both dead. And because we do it so often and we're so used to it, we just don't think of it like this anymore. But driving is a major, major responsibility. And because of that, it's very important that we have rules that we all agree on. And that's why there are things like stop signs and yield signs and stop lights and all those things. The problem is, especially in the United States, as the rules aren't always the same. Every state has different driving rules, and while the basic rules are the same, you stop at a stop sign, for example, not all of them are. I was in West Virginia when I was in college, and they had a law that said that you didn't have to stop at a stop sign if you were turning right and you had a clear view, whereas other states didn't have that law. And in Vermont, I couldn't believe this, but in Vermont, it is completely legal to pass somebody over a double yellow line as long as it's safe. Yeah, the double yellow line that most of us think as the holy cow, don't cross this or you'll die line in Vermont, it's a suggestion. And the reason these laws are different is because these places have different things going on than, say, New York City. In Vermont, there are often farm implements on the road, and they will block the entire lane. And if you weren't able to pass, you would just be stuck in this long line of cars. Anyway, you can see the issue. And of course, when you get to other countries, things are completely different. I remember driving into Canada, and they had lines where it was, if I remember correctly, they were yellow. They may have been white, but there's two yellow lines with dashed lines in the middle. I still don't know what that means. I think I looked it up once, but it didn't stick. So if you're Canadian and you'd like to tell me what the heck that line means, I would really appreciate it so I don't accidentally break some rule I'm unfamiliar with. Anyway, all that said, there are some just basic driving rules that I really think we should agree on, and we don't necessarily, and I wanted to talk about that a bit. I remember when I worked for a company called RPS, which is Roadway Package Systems. I don't think they exist anymore, but they were a UPS competitor. And I was up all night loading trucks and stuff. It was an interesting job. I'll probably have stories about that as time goes on. But one of the guys who was working at the company was formerly of UPS. And UPS, if you've ever worked for UPS, which I have, they have instructions for everything. UPS jobs are not the kind where you're going to be allowed to think on your own. They're all completely about obedience, and that includes driving. So their drivers have to go through a driving program just for UPS, and they have some very unusual rules. One is, UPS trucks are not allowed to turn left, ever. You can't turn left. You have to find a way to turn right enough times to get to where you're going. Now, there's probably some exceptions when there's no other way to do it, but in general, you're not allowed to turn left if you're driving a UPS truck, because that's one of the most dangerous turns there is. Also, and this I disagree with strongly, but this is what we were taught by this guy, he had a video, was space cushion driving. Now, please remember, I am disagreeing with what I'm about to tell you, but the idea behind space cushion driving is that it doesn't matter what lane you're in, you're just trying to be in the lane that's farthest away from the other cars. So if you're in the right lane and there's a bunch of cars there, but there's nobody in the left lane, you should go into the left lane to provide as much space as possible. And while I can see the logic of that, that's terrible. That completely ignores all of the common traffic flow rules that are essential for traffic to actually move. And I suppose in the small context of UPS trucks, which do not spend that much time on highways usually, it's not that big of a deal, but this is terrible if that were general advice. So thinking about all these things made me come up with this list of 10 things, and I just thought I'd go down them here, and some of these are controversial. If you disagree with me, well, you know where to find me. I'm at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And let's dive in here. So, number 1, you can drive safely at 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. I've heard this before. The idea is that, oh, if the speed limit's 35, you can do 45 and the cops aren't going to bother you and whatever. And, well, whether it's safe or not is arguable. I have heard the argument that roads are designed to be handled at faster speeds than the speed limits, and speed limits are often put in place for reasons other than what the road can handle, because maybe there are a lot of animals there or something like that. Well, no. Police can pull you over if you're 1 mile over the speed limit, and while your speedometer is probably only accurate to within 5 miles per hour or 7 kilometers per hour, it doesn't matter. The cops can pull you over for basically anything they want if it's justified by sets of rules that they break all the time. But no, there is no safe zone for speeding. If you're in traffic and there's 13 other cars and everybody is traveling the same speed, there's this thing called common traffic law, which is that you're supposed to maintain the same speed as other cars. And if that speed is above the speed limit, you could argue that, well, I'm following this law. But then you're going to have to argue that in court, because if the cop says you're doing 45 and a 35, it really doesn't matter if everybody else is doing that. So, no, there is no safe speed over the speed limit. In fact, there's also not a safe speed below the speed limit. Cops will also pull you over if you're driving too slow because they think you might be impaired in some way. It's not that uncommon for someone to have too much to drink and realize it and get behind the wheel anyway, which is really stupid, and then figure they'll just drive home slow so nothing happens. Cops know this. They pull you over, and yeah, you lose your license, you're in jail, whatever. Or much worse. Number 2, hands-free devices make phone use while driving completely safe. Well, you knew that was a myth because it has completely safe in it, and there's nothing completely safe in the world. People have died from picking their noses after all, so yeah, there is no completely safe. But is it safer? Is it safe enough that you should do it? Well, studies have shown that the distraction while you're driving isn't from holding the phone in your hand as much as being on the phone call. Being on a phone call uses the parts of your brain that you need to use to pay attention to your driving. So just being on a phone call, even hands-free, puts you and your passengers and everybody else at risk, and it should be minimized as much as possible. I know people that was their habit, that as soon as they got in the car, they'd call somebody, and that was how they drove. They would talk to somebody to pass the time. Yeah, it's not safe, hands-free or not. That said, hands-free is, of course, safer than holding something in your hand, and there are many, many laws against driving with a phone in your hand, but they kind of miss the point. It isn't so much the object, it's the phone call. And if it's illegal to drive with a phone in your hand, why isn't it illegal to drive with a sandwich in your hand? Because it's kind of similar. And in fact, in some jurisdictions, the distracted driving statute will cover anything in your hand. I had a friend who got pulled over because he put a cassette in his cassette player, and he got a ticket for that. Number three, driving barefoot is illegal. Well, no, it's not, actually. In the U.S., anyway, there are no federal or state laws saying that you can't drive barefoot. There may have been some in the past. I've heard this before, and I believed it at one point. In fact, there were barefoot gas pedals that were popular in the hippie days that you could replace your gas pedal with this big metal foot that looked like it was barefoot. And believe it or not, my Tiki Bago, the 1973 Winnebago that's made up like a tiki shack that we bought a few years ago now, had one of those in it, but it wasn't on the gas pedal. It was on the dimmer switch. Which, if the dimmer switch on the floor, you know, that little metal switch. Yeah, I'm old, but there used to be a little metal switch on the floor to make the lights go bright. Anyway, so yeah, driving barefoot is legal. Not necessarily smart, though. That's up to you. I know that some professional drivers who are doing speed runs think it's better to be barefoot because you have a better grip on the pedal. You have to judge that for yourself, but there is an argument to be made that it's not safe. However, it is not illegal. Here's a good one, especially if you're my age. The 10 and 2 hand position on the steering wheel is the safest. That's what I was taught. You keep your hands at 10 and 2, meaning that if the steering wheel was a clock, your hands would be at the 10 o'clock and the 2 o'clock positions. It makes sense. It's a comfortable place to have your hands. You have good control over the wheel. But it's not really true anymore. And the reason is airbags. Airbags are a thing now. And if you hold your hands at 10 and 2 and your airbag goes off, it very well may hit your hands and smash them into your face. That's a bad thing. You don't want that. So the new recommendation, and of course they disagree with each other, is either 9 and 3, just a little bit lower, or 8 and 4. Even lower. Now, I have tried these driving positions, and I find that they're fine, but they give you less control over the wheel. And I don't know if there's actually been a study to show which risk is greater or not. But anyway, that's the official recommendation. Don't do 10 and 2, do 9 and 3, or 8 and 4. I figure nobody's going to pay any attention to that, but that's the recommendation. Number 5, red cars are more likely to get speeding tickets. Well, apparently not. It seems like it should be true, and there's anecdotal evidence to suggest that it is true. If you look at the stats, actually, it's not the red that is the problem. It's the driver's behavior. And it may be that red is a color more commonly found in sports cars, and people with sports cars tend to drive a little too fast. I don't know, but there is no direct correlation between the color of your car and your car being pulled over, believe it or not. So if you want that red van, go ahead and get it. I don't think it's a good idea. I think everyone's van should be silver, white, or gray. That's a whole other topic. But don't worry about getting more tickets just because your van is red. Number 6. You need to warm up your car for several minutes in the winter before driving. I talked about this not too long ago. Modern vehicles aren't like that. Now, sure, back in the old days with carburetors and things like that, stuff needed to warm up a bit before you could drive reliably. I had a 1977 Ford LTD2 that if you didn't let it warm up a minute in the winter, it would stall as soon as you gave it any gas because the carburetor was sticky, whatever. That was a bad engine in that thing. But nowadays, no. Start the car, Wait maybe 5 seconds or so, and then start driving immediately. Drive gently, don't go crazy, but the reason is that all the computers in your vehicle are adjusting your airflow and your gas mixture and your diesel or whatever your vehicle runs on to work just fine under the conditions it's working under. But you're using more gas if it's cold. Your engine is using more gas. So you want to get it up to temperature as quickly as possible, and you do that best by driving. So yeah, just start the thing, make sure everything looks okay, and then head out, drive gently until you're at temperature, and then drive normally. Oh, number 7. Yeah, you probably knew this one was coming. All-wheel drive makes you invincible in snow or ice. No, it doesn't. All-wheel drive is helpful in some cases, and there's a whole big distinction between all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive. I'm not going to get into that now. But I will tell you a quick story. I was driving through Kansas right after a major ice storm. I was driving a Honda Ridgeline pulling a trailer. Okay, this was not the world's most road-grippy situation, you know? And I stayed at a hotel. I got up in the morning. Everything was covered with ice. But apparently, whatever had happened, happened overnight, and I wasn't worried about it, so I kept driving west. I was heading to Colorado, and I noticed that in the median, in the middle of the highway, I believe this was I-70, it was Ford Explorers, like 30 of them, Ford Explorer, all these four-wheel drive vehicles were off the road in the median. And why was it that the four-wheel drive vehicles were there and not, say, the two-wheel drive vehicles? It's because the four-wheel drive people thought they were invincible. And I know that when I owned a Land Rover Discovery 2, a vehicle which for the time had a very advanced four-wheel drive system, it was full-time, real four-wheel drive, which is a fairly rare thing in vehicles of the time, I was a little overconfident in situations like this. And the problem is that your four-wheel drive will help with grip and things like that, but it doesn't help your braking. If you get in a situation where you need to slam on the brakes, your four-wheel drive's not going to help at all. And because you have a four-wheel drive vehicle or an all-wheel drive vehicle, you may have more aggressive tires that tend to work less well on ice. There's a whole lot of detail to talk about here, but the bottom line is, just because you have four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive doesn't mean your vehicle is any safer in inclement weather. It might be a little less likely to get stuck, it might be a little more likely to be able to unstick itself, but at highway speeds, you still need to drive for the conditions. Number 8, this is one for the oldsters, I think. You don't need to wear a seatbelt in the back seat. So, I grew up in the late 60s and 70s and 80s, and that was the time period in which seatbelts first started being mandatory in cars, and then shoulder belts. My 73 Tiki Bago that I just mentioned does not have a shoulder belt. It just has a lap belt, which always made me wonder, like, if you slammed on the brakes, your face would go into the very, very hard steering wheel. Didn't seem like a great design. And yeah, no airbags in there. No, no, no. The only airbags might be some pillows that would fly forward from the bedroom and maybe protect you. No, they wouldn't. So I have seen all these arguments about seatbelts, and there were no seatbelt laws, and then there were, and then there weren't. And anyway, we were often told that in the back seat you don't need seatbelts because if something happens, you're going to be protected by the seats around you. That is absolutely not true. For a long time, my libertarian streak, I have streaks of all political styles, but one of them is libertarian, I suppose, was that since your seatbelt protects only you, there's no reason it should be the law. If you want to risk your own life by not wearing a seatbelt, that's fine. Go for it. I have changed my position on that because I learned and should have realized myself that wearing a seatbelt helps you keep control of your vehicle. And if you don't do that, you're a danger to others. So therefore, not wearing your seatbelt makes you a danger to others, and that's where I draw the line. The same is true for the back seat. Yes, the driver needs to be wearing a seatbelt. Okay, but what about the back seat? Well, imagine a situation where the car is out of control. The driver's belted in. They're trying their best to get the vehicle back in control. But then an 8-year-old kid in the back seat slams them in the head because they weren't buckled in. Now, the 8-year-old kid is obviously at more risk because they're getting tossed around this vehicle and maybe out the window, which happens all the time. But they're also endangering the driver, who could have the 8-year-old kid whack them in the head, make them lose control of the vehicle completely, and hit somebody else. Bottom line, if you're in a vehicle, you should have a seatbelt on. That's all there is to that. If you do not, if you're in a vehicle that's moving and you're not wearing a seatbelt, you are not being as safe as you could be. Number nine, I'm going to mention it even though I hope everybody realizes this, but if you've had only a few drinks, you're still okay to drive. You're not. You can't judge whether you're okay to drive. You can't. You will be wrong. Because what does alcohol do? It impairs your judgment. You cannot drink and then try to use that to figure out, am I okay to drive? I feel like I'm okay to drive. In fact, you know what? I drive better when I'm drunk, which is something that a friend told me and was then arrested for DWI a few times and spent a year in jail. So, yeah, no. You count. If you've had more than one drink per hour, you are not driving. That is the only safe way. Or if you're in a situation where you're responsible for other people, the best rule is 8 hours bottle to throttle. You wait 8 hours between your last drink and when you're going to drive. And that is a rule of many nonprofits, including Team Rubicon. That was our rule. So, no, come on. You know better. And number 10, and this one is the controversial one, believe it or not. The middle lane on a three-lane highway is the fast lane. All right, folks, we need to have a talk about three-lane highways, which would be six-lane highways. And not every country has these, but in the United States, the interstate system often has three lanes on each side. Sometimes it's six on each side if you're like near LA. Sometimes it's only two. It depends on where you are and how the traffic is. Let's talk about the two-lane situation first. The two lanes much simpler. You have a right-hand lane and a left-hand lane. Don't forget, we drive on the right in the US. The right-hand lane is the slow, normal traffic lane. In general, you're going to be in the right-hand lane. The left-hand lane is for passing, so if you have to pass somebody, you get in the left-hand lane, and then as soon as possible, you get back in the right-hand lane. That's how you drive on a two-lane highway, and I don't think too many people disagree with that. The problem is when you have three lanes, because, okay, you've got the right lane, and you've got the middle lane, and you've got the left lane. Well, the left lane is for passing, right? No! I mean, yes, I agree with that, but a lot of people don't. When I was towing farm equipment in Utah, my boss told me that as soon as you get on the interstate, you want to get in that left-hand lane and you sit there. You don't move. You stay in that lane until that's your exit because that's the safest way to be. No! I disagree 100%. I mean, all right, I disagree 95% because I can see some logic behind it. If you're in a vehicle like that, you're towing farm equipment, it's difficult to maneuver, you want to be in the lane that you will have to change things as little as possible. If you're in the right-hand lane, you're going to have to brake more often because people will be taking exits and things like that. But it doesn't matter. If you're driving something like that, you belong in the right-hand lane. Period. End of story. And you shouldn't even pass anything unless it's an extreme situation where somebody's having engine trouble and they're only doing 30 miles an hour or something like that. So that's my first pet peeve with this. The second is, and this is the really hard one that nobody agrees on, what lane should you be in if you are just traveling normally? You're not passing anybody. You're just in the travel lane. You're just going 100 miles on this road. You're not going to take any exits. And you're driving at a regular speed, not passing anybody. What lane should you be in? And the answer is the middle lane. And now people are saying, no, you want to be as right as possible. Well, I disagree, and so does AAA. The middle lane in a three-lane highway is the travel lane. The right lane is now the slow lane. You want to be in the right lane only if you're going slower than traffic or if you're about to take an exit. You want to be in the left lane only if you're passing. That's it. That's how it's supposed to work. And people disagree with that. People want to go back in that right lane and have two passing lanes because, well, let's see, if it's 50 miles an hour and someone's doing 60 and there's someone else doing 70, you want the person doing 70 to be able to pass the person doing 60. No, that is not the proper way to do it. And again, people disagree. And the problem really is that we disagree. If we could all just decide on one and instill that in people, then we wouldn't have the problems we do. And of course, I'm going to call you out here. If you're one of those people who thinks this, which My mother doesn't listen to the podcast very often, so I'm going to try to get away with this. But she told me that if the speed limit is 55, which back in the 80s it was, and you're doing 55, you can stay in the left-hand lane because nobody can legally pass you. So it's just fine. No, it's not. It's not. You are not the pace setter for the highway. This isn't the Indianapolis 500. You should be in the middle lane in that case. The left lane is for passing only. That's the only thing the left lane is for. Anyway, you can see I could rant on this a lot. So, look, if you disagree, send me your arguments. Jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And we can hash it out, and we can maybe even address it again on the podcast. But anyway, that was very long, but there are some road myths for you, and I am okay with taking a long time on that because I think some of that stuff's important. And I hope you didn't learn a thing, honestly. But if you did, good. I'm glad I could help. Special thanks to Kay, Alex, and Terry for buying me some diesel at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. Those folks are the reason there are no ads on this podcast, and I appreciate that very much. I also appreciate the folks who buy me diesel every single month. If you would like to help keep ads off this podcast, please visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo, and you can buy me as much diesel as you would like, and the more diesel means, the fewer ads. And right now, folks have been very, very generous, and I really appreciate that. Van life news. So I put out a call for help because I am really in this spiral of bad news, and everything I look at, like, how does this affect van life? And it's all bad, it's all terrible, and I can't stand it. So I asked folks, I said, look, I know it's not all bad news out there. Surely some of you can find some good news, and you came through for me. So I have four news articles for you here that are relatively good. And thank you, everyone, who brought them to my attention. First, goes to Norm on Facebook. He pointed out that right now in Australia, possibly because of the tariff situation in the U.S., prices for some of the stuff for van life are really good right now. So solar panels and batteries and things like that, stuff that comes from China. Apparently, China is shifting away from the U.S. market. I mean, they produce all this stuff, right? Assuming that the U.S. market would be there, and now they're not so sure. So they're kind of pushing that stuff on Australia at lower prices. So if you are building out a van in Australia, this might be a great time to get all that stuff. Because who knows what the future holds. I mean, my standard thing now is, if you need it and you can buy it, get it. Don't wait. You just don't know what's going to happen. And apparently, Liz from Canada also looked up and saw that things were getting cheaper there too. So if you're not in the U.S., take a look and see if this stuff has become more affordable. If you are in the U.S., well, I don't know what's going on. John in Tennessee pointed out that in Tennessee, which is a state that has not been terribly friendly to van life in recent years, the state parks have decided to put in some accessible trails. So these are trails that you can do in a wheelchair or a motorized wheelchair, and I think that is great. We often will think of van lifers as young, fit, fully abled people. That is not always the case. There are a great many folks in vans who have multiple levels of ability, and some of them can't walk long distances. These trails may let them do that. It may be one of the few trail systems in the country where they can go for a walk with somebody even though they can't walk. So I think this is wonderful, and I appreciate that it's bucking the nationwide trend of getting rid of things like this. And so John gave me two links, and I'll put them both in. One is about the trails, and one is about the all-terrain wheelchairs that people can get. So good stuff there. Thank you, John. Al pointed out something from Colorado that makes me thrilled. And it's from the New York Times, actually, but it's about how Colorado is starting these programs for safe parking. Now, safe parking for homeless people, right? Meaning, you understand my opinion on how there's a huge overlap between van life, homeless people, glam campers, all this. You know, we're all in this big Venn diagram. But we all need a place to park for the night. And Colorado is trying to address that for people who really have no other choice. And And it's called the Colorado Safe Parking Initiative, CSPI, which was actually founded in 2020. But the idea is that they're trying to organize churches and nonprofits to basically have safe parking lots for people who are finding themselves homeless. I don't know that they're going to allow any old van to roll in there if you're just trying to travel through the area, but it doesn't matter. This helps everybody in van life, because if these folks have a place to park, that frees up other spaces, and it also prevents the horrible situation of certain streets just having a whole lot of decrepit RVs on them, and that's where we get into a lot of trouble. So this is a great program. And it's more than just parking. They're trying to actually create a sense of community amongst people who use this. And if they need it and want it, they will help folks try to transition into permanent housing. So a couple of places that are doing this, the First Universalist Church of Denver is trying this out. And also Loveland, Colorado has the Safe Lot Parking Area, which is a citywide effort. And oh, that's such great news. Al, thank you so much for sending me that. I really needed that bit of good news specifically. And I'll have the article in the show notes. It's a New York Times article. I have a non-paywalled link, thanks to Al. He gave me a gift article, but those often stop working, so you might have to find it through another source. And finally, Darren and Karen, the rhyming duo, which is something I named them, and it probably annoys them, but my podcast. sorry, guys. Thank you for sending this. Darren and Karen sent this article from Vice about this game that I can't remember if I talked about or not, because there's quite a few van life games now, but this game is called Outbound. Outbound, and it just passed Kickstarter. It's available now, and this game is a combination of Firewatch and Minecraft and The Sims, maybe with a little bit of Long Dark thrown in there. It's a casual building game, but it starts off with you and your electric-powered Volkswagen bus, and you're basically outfitting your bus and making it have all the things you need to do van life, and then you set up camp, and you set up camp exactly as you want, and boy, you can set up elaborate camps with this game, let me tell you. It has weather that matters, the graphics are beautiful, and you can also have jeeps and things like that and do some overland expeditions. It's a casual, cozy game. If you're just looking for something to play and you just want to feel good and feel like you've accomplished something and you don't want to be, you know, going pew, pew, pew or anything like that, this might be a game for you. And plus, it's van lifey. You might even get some ideas from your build from this game. So thanks very much to Darren and Karen for sharing that. I'll have a link in the show notes to the Vice.com article, which talks about it. But I am definitely going to get this game. There's no question. Tech Talk. Michael wrote to me and asked about cigarette lighter outlets versus USB ports. A friend of his is building out a van, and they think cigarette lighter ports are old and obsolete, which seems to be the opinion of the RV community, because very, very few RVs come with cigarette lighter outlets anymore. Cars are starting to stop coming with them too. You know, and if that's the case, why bother putting them in? Why not just put in dedicated USB outlets? My argument, which I've made before, is that it's not time yet. It's not time yet. We're still in a transitional period with USB. But when I started this podcast, USB-A was really all there was. USB-C was just starting to come around. Now USB-C is far more common, except there's so much legacy USB-A stuff out there that you find it. And the problem is that, let's say you bought a... I have this problem in my Airstream. I can explain it completely. My Airstream, built in 2018, does not have any cigarette lighter plugs, but it does have a bunch of USB ports. Well, great, right? Well, no, because these USB ports are old 1-amp USB-A ports, and if you were to charge your phone with them, it would take forever. If you wanted to charge your laptop, like my MacBook Pro, which can be USB charged, it wouldn't even do it, or if it would, it would take days. The outlets are obsolete, and so what I need to do is replace them, except that's not so easy, because the wiring that supports these USB plugs was there to support those USB plugs. And if I put in a high power USB plug in there, I also have to upgrade the wiring and whatever fuse is on that wiring. And that's a lot of work. Back to the cigarette lighter plugs. One thing we have in great quantity is cigarette lighter plug USB chargers. There's millions and gazillions of them out there, and they are easy to replace. Now, I am not a fan of cigarette lighter ports. I don't like them. I don't like the technology. I don't like how there's so many of them are so cheap. I don't like how they melt sometimes. I'm just not a fan in general. But for this one purpose, I think they make a lot of sense. And so if you're building out a rig, I recommend that instead of putting USB ports where you want them to be, consider putting cigarette lighter ports and then putting a USB plug in there. And that can change with the time. Cigarette lighter ports require substantial wiring. So you're going to have that handled. By definition, any USB adapter that you put into your cigarette lighter port is going to be compliant with that wiring, because otherwise it wouldn't be certified as a cigarette lighter device. And you can change it. That's the big thing. You can change it. Say you have an iPhone 10 right now and you have a USB-A charging cord and you're going to get a new one and oh no, it's USB-C. You can just change the entire adapter just by you pull it out and put in a new one. Because of that, I think you should at least have one or two or maybe more cigarette lighter plugs in your build. Out your build, you should do what you want. Just understand that you may encounter the situation I have with my Airstream, which I have basically unusable USB ports in there. One caveat on this, cooking with 12 volts, which I have done and I enjoy, I have found to be problematic over the years because the cigarette lighter outlets melt. Even the factory ones, even the heavy duty ones. If you're going to do this, buy the heaviest duty ones you can. Don't get the cheap ones. Avoid plastic if you can. You want one with a ceramic insulator inside, not a plastic one. That's getting harder to find. But if you're going to do a lot of 12 volt cooking, here's some strange advice, but I think it's very solid. Pick a place in your van where you're going to do that 12 volt cooking and don't put in a cigarette lighter outlet there. Put in an Anderson connector there, a big Anderson connector. You can Google that if you're not familiar with it. It's a big, robust, heavy-duty, strong connector. And you can either add a cigarette lighter adapter to that or cut the plug off of whatever 12-volt device you're using and wire an Anderson connector on there and plug it in directly. You're going to have to add a fuse because the plugs often have fuses in them. But you can put that fuse anywhere on the circuit. And that's going to give you a more robust connection and better cooking. And you're not going to be in risk of melting things. For the ones that you're just doing USB on, they don't have to be that. You can just use the regular cigarette lighter plug. But for cooking, I recommend you change over to Anderson if you can. If there are any professional builders out there, I hope you're listening. Those 12-volt cigarette lighter plugs are still useful. There are a lot of things that can go in there still. And you can always change them. And, you know, I'll probably change this a few years from now. But as of right now, that's my recommendation. Product review. I am sorely tempted to just do another product review of the Gaia Top fan that I did a few weeks ago. Because I love these things. Just very quick plug for this thing. It's a $13 fan. I now own three of them, and I use them all the time. It's got little GorillaPod feet. You can connect it to anything. It's tiny. I mean, it's not tiny. It's the size of a Big Mac, maybe. But it pumps out tons of air. It has a battery. It's USB-C rechargeable. It is a bargain at $13, and I really think everybody should have these fans. I mean, I should just buy them by the case and give them away as party favors or something. But yeah, okay, enough about that. I'm a little excited about it. Instead, I want to tell you about my Leatherman Wingman, which is a multi-tool that I've used to build just about everything, including both my builds. I've had it in my pocket for 9 years. And the other day, maybe a couple weeks ago now, it wasn't in my pocket. And I don't know where it was. Sometimes the cat will knock it off the counter where I store it at night, and it wasn't there either. And because I'm hobbling around and I'm wearing sweatpants a lot, which I hardly ever do, I think it fell out of my pocket and is in a supermarket somewhere, and I'm never going to get it back. Now, some of the parts are wearing out. I had broken the scissors a while ago, so okay, time to get a new multi-tool. Multi-tools are expensive. But they're worth it, in my opinion. I really think that all van lifers could benefit from having a multi-tool, and there's a whole bunch of different ways to go. And so when I was looking at a replacement, I looked at the Leatherman ones, and I was like, geez, they're so expensive. I mean, how much of that is quality and how much of that is just brand? And I don't know. So I looked at some of the knockoffs and I actually found one that was interesting. It's called a Roxxon S as in Sam, 801 as in Utah, S again, and then Storm. So the Roxxon S801S Storm. Strange name. Very beefy multi-tool. And what attracted me to this was, it has this thing, it's just hard to explain. A lot of multi-tools have pliers and then wire cutters. You're familiar with that. A whole bunch of screwdrivers that come out. A saw, file, all that. This one has a full-size pair of scissors that fold out from nowhere. I mean, when I was first looking at the ads, I was like, why did they set it down on a top of a pair of scissors? Because those scissors are way too big to come from that device. But I was wrong. They're in there. So if you're somebody who uses scissors a lot, this might be a great tool. Also, it's heavy enough to be fairly beefy. The pliers are strong, but they're not really needle nose, which I wish they came to a finer tip. And they're actually a little narrower than a lot. But it does have both wire cutters, a soft and a hard. And it looks like it's sort of replaceable. I mean, it's riveted in there, not screwed in like some of the Leathermans are. It has a Phillips screwdriver and a can opener and a bottle opener and a threader, which is really an awl. I mean, you could sew something really coarse with this thing. It has a very useful saw. It has a glass breaker. It's a little carbide tip so you can smash a window out with it. And it has a corkscrew, a very beefy, completely usable corkscrew with bottle opener. So it's 19 tools. It's fairly large. It's fairly heavy. It actually has a bit driver, and it comes with bits as well. So you can do little tiny screws, big screws, whatever. And if you want to get into it, you can start using sockets with it too. The reason that I am going to recommend this thing with some caveats is that it's $47. That's really cheap. That's cheaper than anything even close to being comparable Leatherman. Like a Leatherman Wave now, which is the most common tool, is $120. This thing's $47. And it's not one of those really crappy cheap ones that maybe somebody gave you in your stocking or that you picked up for $20 at Home Depot. This is an actual substantial tool. Now, why am I only giving it a partial recommendation? Well, it's big. It's kind of big. It's a little too big for everyday carry for me. It does not have a belt clip. It has a holster, which is fine. But for me, I wanted something everyday carry. The entire time I'm in my van and doing van, I'm always reaching for my multi-tool. I want it to be with me all the time. And this thing is so big that I think I would just tend to take it out and lay it on something. But that said, if you had this in a drawer in your van, and if you wore it when you were working on something actively, I think it would be very useful. And it, for the price, it's really high quality. It's not as high quality as a Leatherman, but it's really high quality. For the price, you feel like you got something of value. So I'll have a link in the show notes for that. Again, it's the Storm S801. You have to take a look at it to see what I'm talking about with these scissors. It is crazy. They're huge. And if you don't need scissors, well, this isn't the tool for you. By the way, because this thing was so big, I actually went out and bought a Leatherman Wave, which is a tool I've had before, and that will be my new everyday carry. And as soon as I got it from Amazon and put it in my pocket, I went out to my truck. And guess what was sitting in the seat of my truck? Yes, my Leatherman Wingman, waving hi. So now I have two, which isn't a bad thing. Tales from the Road. Oh, okay, this is a little sad. Yes, it's a sad tale from the road, and I've already told several of you that this was going to happen. But don't worry, it's not so bad. But I got to go to my van. My wife and I found the time, and the weather was good enough, and I can walk well enough, almost anyway, that we were able to go and check out the van, and we were going to spend the weekend in the Airstream and visit the Tiki Bago and the Scamp, basically go back down to the property that we haven't been to since January, make sure everything was okay, and do our first camping of the year. All kinds of birds are flying through, and there's all kinds of animals and stuff, and, you know, really, really nice. We love being down there, and I know my wife loves it, so this was an event for us. We were really looking forward to it. Now, we couldn't really deal with water yet because my source of water in Chicago is still shut off for the winter. So we're like, okay, we'll do winter camping even though it's not that cold. So we do all the preparation and we get down there, and I actually drive my truck down there, which is my first actually driving of any substance that I've done since I had my surgery. So everything is great. I'm starting to feel alive again. All these ideas for projects are coming into my head. I'm like, okay, this is going to be okay. I'm going to be able to do stuff. And then we get there, and I have a chain to take off and stuff, pull up to the property, quick glance around, everything's fine. Nothing happened. You know, we left the property for months and nobody touched it, which is great. Of course, we have all these cameras, so we would have known if anybody had. And I get out of my truck and hobble over to the Airstream. And as I'm getting closer to the door of the Airstream, I realize that I left all the keys in Chicago. And traffic was so bad that it would have taken me at least 5 hours to go back and get the keys and come back down and open everything up. We were on our property in our campground with not one, not two, not three, but four campers. And we didn't have keys for any of them. I haven't built out my truck yet, so we couldn't stay there. The Sprinter van is completely locked up, and the keys for that were not with me. The keys for the Airstream weren't with me. The keys for the Winnebago weren't with me. And the keys for the Scamp weren't with me. And I just, like, I was so looking forward to getting in my van and actually starting it and seeing if it would even start and maybe chasing the mice out. And I was just, that moment, I was so defeated because ever since January, I've been sitting around wishing I could get in my van and then I could get to it, and all I could do was give it a gentle hug and look through the window, and that was it. And I actually thought, you know, maybe I'll just break the window. I mean, I've got this multi-tool with the window breaking thing on it now. And then I was like, I stopped myself before I got too far. Now, I have broken into RVs before. I have done that. And I remember one time I left the keys in a fifth-wheel RV I was living in. And that was bad because that was our house at the time. And the way I got into that was, well, I happened to have a five-year-old with me. And I was able to open an outer door. The five-year-old crawled in and got inside and unlocked the door. Hero. But I didn't have one of those with me. The way the Airstream is, there's just no way to do that. It's a very secure vehicle. And the Tiki Bago, also, there just really isn't a way to do that. And then I did something that was smart. I asked my wife if I could look at her keys. And there was a key on there. And it was the key to the Tiki Bago. So the weekend was saved. We got into the Tiki Bago, which was actually kind of a mess. The problem with the Tiki Bago is that over the winter, everything moves in there. Ladybugs, stink bugs, and mice. They all love to go in there, and there's just no way to seal it. I have traps out and stuff, so basically I unlocked the door with great excitement and said, why don't you stay out here and watch the river for a while? And then I went in and removed any critters, which then became food for the other critters. And then we spent an hour cleaning, and we had a lovely, wonderful evening in the Tiki Bago playing Abduction, if you're familiar with that game. And it was nice, and it made me realize that the Airstream has kind of gotten us away from these nice moments, because the Airstream is so much like a house that we do what we do at home. You know, we go in there, we make dinner, we turn on the TV, and then we just sit and veg and play games on our phones and watch TV. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's completely fine. But it's not the same thing as just playing a game with somebody without any distraction of TV or anything. And we used to do puzzles all the time in the Tiki Bago, because when we first got it, we were basically boondocking in the thing. We didn't have any way to do anything else. So we'd buy puzzles, and we'd spend the night building puzzles and listening to old-time radio or Night Vale or something like that. And now we kind of don't do that anymore because we've got the TV, we've got internet, we've got a full kitchen, you know, we've got a house. And it just made me kind of think back to how this all started, which was just building out a van. And there's nothing wrong with any of this, but it was just an interesting perspective. And then the next day, the weather wasn't going to be great, so we drove away, and in the rearview mirror, I saw the van getting smaller and smaller, untouched. I was not able to get into it, to start it, to do anything. And that was a heartbreaking moment. However, there are always more moments, and we now have plans to go this weekend. And I've already taken the keys and attached them to my keychain that I need to drive the truck. So we will have keys. But boy, that was disappointing. We made the best of it. We had a wonderful time. But I think the van is mad at me. And I think next week, it's very likely I'll have a story about how my van won't start. We shall see. And this is where I'm supposed to have a place to visit, but I'm not going to do it because this podcast is too long. So next week, you'll hear about this crazy place that happens to be in France. Resource recommendation. Okay, I'm being long-winded again, which means a very quick resource recommendation. Have you ever heard of boatboard? Boatboard. Boatboard is a whole class of things that are boards. They're big panels that are suitable for marine use, which means they won't rot or anything. They're waterproof, basically. So HDPE boat board is a thing. HDPE stands for high density polyethylene. It's the stuff that milk cartons are made of in the U.S. Not in Canada, because they have bags. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. But yes, boat board is something you should know about for your build, because you may have situations where you need, like, basically a big sheet of hard plastic. You can use it to cover tables, you can use it to make furniture. There's all kinds of things you can do with this stuff, and it's available on Amazon now. So I have a link in the show notes, and if you follow that link, you're going to get to this page where you can choose all different sizes and thicknesses and colors of this boat board stuff, and it just might be exactly the material you need for some weird situation. One of the nice things about HDPE is that it's easy to cut. You can cut it with a knife, you can cut it with a jigsaw, you can shape it, you can sand it to make it smooth. It's a fairly decent material to work with, and it doesn't have any of the problems of wood. Now, it's going to look like plastic because that's what it is, but you could cover it with something or not. I don't mind the look of plastic personally. Some people hate it. That's your choice. But the material is there. You should know about it. So even if you're not going to buy this stuff, I recommend you take a look at the link so you're at least aware of it, because then when you do need it, it will trigger something in your mind and you'll know where to find it. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to yet another long episode. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And holy cow, do I have a lot of travel coming up. You are going to hear so many tales from me. I'm going all over the place this year. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to meet up with any of y'all, but I will let you know if there's an opportunity. Until next time, remember the words of Unknown, who said, "Driving can be a spectacular form of amnesia. You're behind the wheel, and suddenly the world behind you fades." Cigarette light outer. Cigarette outlet. And I